Hello and welcome to This Week in Oklahoma Politics. I'm your host, KOSU's Michael Cross, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, with only a couple days left before the deadline, Governor Fallon signed House Bill 3399, repealing Common Core, a set of standards she herself had championed as head of the National Governors Association. The bill was supported by several right-wing groups, but opposed by state and municipal chambers of commerce. Ryan, were you surprised by this move?
No, not at all. I think that this was dominated by politics from the beginning, and what we saw was a political outcome. The United States Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, was asked about Oklahoma's passage of this law repealing Common Core. And he asked, you know, what's changed? Well, the only thing that's changed is politics. Back in February, not that long ago, Governor Fallon, who has a leadership role in the National Governors Association, was championing Common Core. There was another governor who expressed concern over the conspiracy theories that have been floated against Common Core. And she said, oh, it's frustrating. So she got it. But at the end of the day, she folded and she gave into those conspiracy theorists. And she made a political decision based on myth that has actually nothing to do with the standards that were put in place.
And so, Neva, where does Oklahoma go from here?
Well, I think first of all, yes, it was political. I mean, we've all talked about the fact that this had become the most polarizing issue probably in the campaign season here in Oklahoma. It's something that became very confusing, became a subject that, frankly, every politician, you know, was being asked about and had to make statements about. And I think what got lost, as I've said before, is it was about really at the beginning, it was Republicans and conservative leaders across the country that were developing something to really accelerate the need for improved academic standards and a lot of things that people agree with. But it got tainted, frankly, when Barack Obama and many of the Washington bureaucrats seized it and became clear that it was going to be a federal intrusion, that they were going to be much more aggressive in what they wanted in terms of teaching and testing strategies and curricula. And that was, at that point, it did become toxic in Oklahoma, and rightfully so. So I think the governor, Superintendent Barisi, who again, like Governor Fallon, said, yes, we started down this road, but now we're taking a change in direction. And the reason is we need to regroup, retool, come to the table and begin to bring all of the parties involved and do something different, because bottom line, it is going to require that there be a change in how education is done in Oklahoma.
Ryan, the State Department of Education has 2 years to put this together, but as it stands right now, we don't even know who's going to be in charge of the State Department of Education in the next year.
Well, and I think even more problematic than that is that under one of the provisions of this bill, the legislature gets to play a role not just in approving or rejecting the ultimate standards, but they're going to get to play with the actual meat of the standards themselves. So you've got the State Department of Education, you have the legislature. I think it's very difficult to see how we come up with a set of standards in 2 years. I think that Governor Fallon herself, as recently as early in 2014, was reiterating the fact that these standards in Common Core were created by people in Oklahoma. It wasn't a matter of federal intrusion. It was really a matter of Barack Obama saying that he thought the Common Core standards were an appropriate set of standards for schools around the country, and they should be developed by local leaders. The governor's spokesperson, whenever she signed this piece of legislation, you know, said as much. He said it became perceived that this was a Barack Obama-sponsored or endorsed plan, and that was one of the reasons that this repeal of Common Core took place. I think that the governor had an opportunity to be a leader here. And to stand up to the conspiracy theorists, stand up to the folks that really, and when I say conspiracy theorists, these are the folks that went on the legislative floor and took excerpts from books that they thought were, damning to Common Core, said it was a UN conspiracy theory. The governor could have been a leader and said, that's not what this is, doubled down on that. I'm not for consistency for the sake of consistency, but she shouldn't have given in to the conspiracy theorist here.
Yeah, I think what we have is a situation now where all parties have an opportunity to step up to the plate and say, yes, we can do better. And the governor, in her statement, one of the things she also said was Oklahoma has the ability to develop superior standards, and she would be one of the driving forces to advocate for that. So I think it's just a reset. I think, and I will say this, while legislators and others may think they'll have an inordinate influence in the process, I think what we may see is parents and teachers and others that are really the most affected parties in educating the kids in Oklahoma, they may much more be engaged in this process, and out of the fury and out of all of the dust settling, I think that'll be a good thing.
In the meantime, we could lose some federal funding, and we could have greater federal intrusion in our schools if the No Child Left Behind waiver that we have in place in Oklahoma is removed by the federal government.
I think that remains to be seen, but it's certainly something that people are talking about.
Yeah.
Now, the federal government recently announced it is moving as many as 1,400 young people to Fort Sill, just outside of Lawton. These children appear to be in this country illegally and without parents in the U.S. They'll be housed there until family can be located. Neva, the move is causing a great deal of controversy, especially among Oklahoma's delegation.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, Tom Cole and others who have stepped forward and said, look, I mean, this is, first of all, an inappropriate use of military facilities. And, you know, he expressed great concern about the fact that if you take this and it begins as an emergency measure, that over time it may evolve into what we have as a permanent juvenile detention facility for these young folks that have entered the country illegally. So it opens a big can of worms. I think there's a big question on, you know, the reddest state in the United States becomes the kind of the focal point where they, you know, where they bring these children to Fort Sill, I guess today, that they're talking about the first groups will arrive. But it's a crazy process, and I think it's one that there's going to be continued pushback, and we'll see what happens with the outrage not only in Oklahoma but in Washington.
Ryan, these are essentially refugees from Central and South America. What is it? Is it the wrong plaything for a military base to be using this?
Well, it's the folks that have been involved at the federal government have said that this is a temporary measure. There's hope of finding sponsors or some reunification with the children. I think that there is a need for transparency in the conditions in those facilities. There's a need to ensure that these children are afforded every legal right afforded to them, both under the United States law and international law. They're essentially refugees. The governor standing up and saying that these are illegal immigrants and that we need to tighten down our borders, I think misses the point that these are children that are escaping some of the most violent areas in the world, and they're coming to the United States, traveling across deserts on the tops of trains, in the trunks of cars, in conditions that I think just really break our heart if you really take the time to look at it. You know, and when Governor Fallon was first running for election in the primary, she was asked what distinguished her from her opponent, and she said it was because one of the things that distinguished her is that she was a mother. I don't think she's thinking like a mother right now. Because if she was, she would realize that these harsh words against these children really miss the point that we're dealing with a humanitarian crisis that needs to be addressed.
And yes, the focus of the 1,200 children sounds like something that gives us all pause. Granted, it's a very difficult situation, but let's look at the rest of the story. You have children and teens, 47,000 unaccompanied minors that have been taken into custody at the border since October of last year. So we're not talking small numbers. They continue to escalate, and it is an issue where if this is their stopgap measure to deal with it, I think it opens a lot more questions and seems like a very not so well thought out proposition on the part of the administration on how they're going to handle this long term.
And I think that, you know, we're at a point where Neva makes a good point. The way that we deal with this growing number of refugees coming from Central America is a defining moment for the United States. We need to make sure that we're doing it right. We're doing it transparent, with the utmost transparency and the utmost respect for the due process of law that these children deserve. But at the end of the day, this is a humanitarian crisis of significant magnitude. And politicians like Governor Fallon and others that I think are using this as an opportunity to grandstand on illegal immigration are missing the point. These folks run for office and they say on their Christian values, well, this is Christianity of convenience. You know, they like to use their Bible whenever it allows for suspension of critical thought or it allows them to discriminate against somebody. But here they're being asked to treat somebody as a decent human being, and they need to read those parts as well.
Finally, I know this isn't really central to Oklahoma, but on Tuesday, the political world got a shock when a Tea Party newcomer defeated the second most powerful Republican in the U.S. House. Neva, what does the re-election loss by Eric Cantor to David Bratt mean to the future of the Grand Ole Party?
Well, I think, first of all, we always say that there are always surprises in every election cycle. This one will be hard to top, granted, because you have a situation, really, from all indications, that you have a congressman who had not paid much attention back at home in the district, that he had spent too much time national fundraising, national politics, positioning himself, you know, as one of the national leaders. And that caused problems with the home folks. And it set up an opportunity for someone who was not well-funded to basically get on the ground, develop a grassroots campaign that caught fire. Many times the same scenario plays out and it doesn't catch fire. The inordinate amount of money from the incumbent dwarfs the challenger. They don't get any traction, and it's kind of a footnote in history. But in this case, it becomes something that everybody has to step back, I think, give pause to, and say, really, it is about retail politics, and there is no person running for office. And I think Ryan, having been there and experienced it himself, would probably be the first to say, you don't take anything for granted, and you do ask the voters back home to send you back.
Right, and you also got to see that, you know, if there hadn't been a Democrat running, then Bratt would be the next congressman from that district. How does this show how important it is to have a Democrat or any opposing person running for against an incumbent on the other party?
You never know what's going to happen in these primaries. I think that, of course, as Neva, I agree with everything that Neva said. That this is, I know, all the lightning was Thursday morning, so maybe when this is airing, we'll be okay. I think that when we look at the impact of this race, it definitely shows that Democrats need to be positioned to take advantage of these where you know, fringe candidates get the nomination. I think Neva's explanations are right on. They're the rational explanation for this. My concern is that the rational explanation, the fact that Cantor didn't engage in retail politics, didn't invest in his district like he should have, will be lost on incumbent politicians in the next legislative cycles, both in Congress and in state legislatures, and they're going to cling to the irrational. If I don't take the most extreme position possible, I put myself in a position to be ousted, just like Eric Cantor. And so my concern, you know, immigration reform, we're already talking about that being dead at the national level. I think at the state level, I'm concerned about the irrational reaction that we're going to have from candidates. They're going to be even more afraid.
Well, and it was interesting. One of the things that Cantor did that I thought was unusual against a very underfunded candidate, a guy that spent about $100,000 or something on media, is he spent $2 million on negative media against a guy that basically it did was give him credibility. So you had that compounded by the fact that you had a spike in turnout. You had 65,000 voters, and that was something like 18,000 over the norm. So there were a lot of very unusual variables that collided in this election.
Proving once again, the negative ads don't always work.
Right. Well, you know, Cantor spent more to steakhouse than this guy on steakhouses than this guy spent on his entire campaign. You know, that's, again, I think that there are all of these very rational explanations for why Cantor lost. My concern is that gets lost in the idea that Cantor lost because he wasn't conservative enough.
The biggest is all politics is local, as we know. Yeah. Thank you very much. Ryan and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.